Okay, I want to talk to you today about a piece of work that's come out of what I'm working on for my PhD dissertation. And my PhD dissertation is looking at the arrival of the Hudson Bay Company in the first 100 years, 1670 to 1770, when they arrive on the shores of Hudson Bay. And whereas my dissertation focuses on a variety of impacts that the Hudson Bay Company has on First Nations and on the landscape, changing in food culture, I want today to talk about another aspect of what that colonization by the Hudson Bay Company in Rupert's Land, that area that is known as Rupert's Land, what it does to the Indigenous people that are living there when the Hudson Bay Company arrives. What they begin is more than just a simple fur trade venture. They trigger a change in Mishkegwik foodways, and this is what I want to talk about today. Once a community of hunter-gatherers, Mishkegwik societies became dependent upon gardening and then later on groceries, and they began to forget, and they indeed have forgotten, those gathering traditions. Europeans identified the people living here as Cree, but they self-identify as Mishkegwik, and this means people of the Muskeg. The traditional way of life for Mishkegwik were a hunter-gatherer society, a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, where they lived in small, mobile kinship groups, and they lived off the land, moving about as the seasons dictated and the geography provided those sustenance needs that they actually relied upon. They did not, however, live in total isolation. Social interaction included meeting with other Mishkegwik, as well as interacting with other First Nations groups for both trade and for cultural events as well. The Mishkegwik world included gendered division of labor, including tasks related to food. Men hunted and did some fishing, and women were involved in a much wider range of food work, including fishing, small game hunting, gathering plant foods, and cooking all the meals as well. So our focus today is specifically on the inclusion of gathered plant foods in the Mishkegwik diet. A wide range of scholars have recognized that First Nations peoples ate plant foods, but this has historically garnered very little attention. And there are two dominant reasons why this ends up happening. First is that physical artifacts that are left behind have predominantly been bones. Plant foods leave very little visible evidence, especially as we go through a century or two. So it was assumed on the basis of that physical evidence that was left behind, that it was fauna, not flora, that Indigenous people chose to eat. Improvements to science is slowly changing that story. We see DNA studies now that are being used to identify a really wide range of plant foods that First Nations people did eat. They can go into artifacts now, do DNA analysis on almost invisible particles left behind in these artifacts, and they determine that plant foods have played a very significant role in First Nations diets. The second reason we see very little mention of plant foods in First Nations history is in regards to gender. Male-centered history has resulted in only looking at the hunting enterprise, or the hunting and some of the fishing enterprise. First Nations men did not have the knowledge or the interest in the gathering and the cooking processes, as that chore belonged to women. And as in the case of even our modern society, many husbands eat what their wives put in front of them, and they don't ask what actually that food contains. I know in my house, it's like, don't ask, don't tell, right? So we see that same idea replicated for historians who are talking to hunters about what they're eating. They're focusing on the food that they are getting. They're not focusing on what their wives, what the women may have put in front of them. When First Nations women's history began to become researched and written about, much of the traditional gathering knowledge had already been lost for several generations. It doesn't take very many generations of not having these food resources before we see them actually being lost. And today, with a resurgence of interest in food security, people are once again looking at the role of plant foods in First Nations diets. Right? They're starting to think about the history of gathering culture, to think about what wild plants mean to people that are living that subsistence diet as well. And they're looking to see how we can actually now create a place for them in the contemporary diet. So we have to ask this question of how do we gather this, how do we recover this gathering knowledge, right? How do we find plant food knowledge if it is missing, But if it's been forgotten for so many generations, so much time has passed that if you talk to First Nations people, there's little conversation about plant foods. The people that I have talked to about this have come back to me afterwards and said, you know what? Now that I think about it, my grandma did this. My mother did this. But I don't really know what that plant is. And we don't do that anymore. And it's been more generations than that. A lot of First Nations people have no memory of gathering plant foods from their environment other than berries. And as a result, when historians are looking at what plant foods are being eaten by First Nations people, quite often the focus is that these people were frolicking through the bush picking raspberries or something, right? So thinking about the wide variety of food resources that are actually available. So there are three methods that can be used to discover traditional plant food use. The first method is identified use. This is the most basic way of doing it. This is the easiest way of uncovering this. Right? This is where there is specific reference made either in written histories or in recorded oral histories or in actual collected oral histories where, yes, I remember we ate this plant. Very simple, very straightforward. The second method gets a little more complex, and this relies upon group use, right? This is the case where the Meshkigwik experience may be discussed as part of a larger history that includes more than Meshkigwik people, may include other First Nations groups. It may be on a topic that's totally unrelated to food and food history. In this case, we need to tease out those references that we're looking for, as they may be mentioned in a different context, and so we have to pull apart the little details that are included and realize that what they are talking about are specific plant foods that are part of the diet. And the third use is assumed use. The third method is assumed use. This is much more intensive. And this is where historical resources make no reference to Meshkigwik use of wild plants. But we know what happened. So we need to sort of rebuild this trail to discover how and what plants were being eaten historically by Meshkigwik people and how we can consider those in a more modern context. We start by identifying the plants that are found in the Hudson Plains. And there are a large number of biologists and ethnobiologists who are interested in this. So there is a large amount of gathering that is actually happening, or recording at least what plants grow in the area. Then we cross-reference these plants against other regions where indigenous use is recorded. And there are other areas of Canada where indigenous plant use has been maintained and has been recorded. Here we are assuming that plant food knowledge has crossed geographical lines, remembering that, of course, our geography is socially constructed by us in our own time and our own place. They may have been part of First Nations cultures. They may have been part of economic exchanges as well. This method is based in part on Arthur Ray's work on First Nations economic patterns. And he has suggested that there is extensive evidence of this pre-contact Aboriginal trade network, right, with cultural implications that go along with it. And this has existed long in North American history prior to any type of European contact. It is further supported by the work of Matthew Boyd and other anthropologists at Lakehead University, and they've studied maize culture in North Dakota and Manitoba, and they actually discovered that corn was being traded into climatic regions that did not support its growth. So those are just two very simple explanations or supports of this system of looking at other geographical areas and other uses and then applying that to Meshkigwik use. So if we put together all three of these methods, we can start to rebuild knowledge of Meshkigwik food use. And evidence to date indicates that there is an abundance of wild plant foods in the Hudson Plains and that these plants have had a large use in the early Meshkigwik diet. Wild plant foods have a wide range of use, and this does really make them a valuable resource. We have to sort of disconnect ourselves from our modern way of thinking that one plant has one use, right? One food source has one use. We pick a potato and we eat a potato a certain way. We have to broaden ourselves beyond that. As I've discovered in my own research on the Hudson Bay Company and their gardening methods, that we have to think beyond what we do in our contemporary society and look at how food was used in a different time period and in a different place itself. So let's take a look at a few of the plants that have been found in the Hudson Plain, and we're going to see how they could regain, I guess, comfort within that Meshkigwik system, add to the Meshkigawik diet and how they were used in the past. And this is using all three methods that I had previously explained. Wapato is also known as arrowhead, and it's also called Indian potato. In some places, it's referred to as that as well. The plant tubers were often roasted and eaten. They were also added to meat stews. Sometimes they were dried and eaten later as a dried, just as something to snack on. The dried tuber was often pounded into a flour-like substance. And this flour-like substance had several purposes. Often it was added to soups, or it could be made into a mush, sort of like grits or polenta, and eaten that way. Or they would make it into a bread-like cake, and depending upon what other products were available at the time, it might be mixed in with wild seeds, wild berries as well, to make a cake-like substance. We see this method with drying roots and then pounding them into a flour used in a variety of other plants as well. Bracken ferns were eaten the same way. The roots of the bracken fern were eaten the same way, the rhizomes. And the young plants, and we've all, I'm sure, have seen at least fiddleheads in our modern-day supermarket, and of course they were available at that in that time place to Meshkigawik people as well. If you see recipes today for fiddleheads, they usually tell you to boil them or to sauté them or something like that. And First Nations people often ate them raw, or they would be added to that ever-boiling soup pot that was going on and that was thickened and flavored with whatever was available at any given time. Fireweed is another plant that, if you're familiar, at least in Northern Ontario, it's almost a weed. We see it everywhere that we go. I'm not sure of how common it is in the South, but it does grow in weed areas. So it's listed as being a Canada-wide plant from coast to coast, and it was used by First Nations people from coast to coast. And we know it was part, an important part of the Meshkigawik diet as well. It had several food uses, and I can't wait for fireweed to come out. I've tried eating the little shoots, and it makes a wonderful addition to the salad, or picking the leaves and putting them in your salad. The flowers is another nice aspect to add to to salads. You can put the fireweed flowers in there. But they also boiled the young shoots. They would take the stems, and inside the stems there's a pithy material, and they would scrape that out and use that to boil it up, or they would even sometimes eat it raw. It could be quite sweet when it was actually, the plant had been towards the end of its growing season. The pith would be quite sweet as well. An interesting use for the outer stem was to boil it and to make the sweet syrup that would then could either be saved, or it could be weakened further and drank, or it could be added to other foods to make them a little bit more sweeter, so that if a wild food did have those bitter notes, that this was one way of sweetening it up. Another one that we can take a look at is wild celery. This is a plant that grows across the north as well. In many parts of Canada it was grown. Interesting, this is one that was also found in Orkney, Scotland, where many of the Hudson Bay Company men come from, so they were familiar with it as well. You may know it by the name Angelica, is another name that it was known by. It was harvested for its leaves, its stalks, its seed as well. The stalks could be peeled and were eaten raw, just something to crunch on. The leaves were often used as a boiled vegetable, the same way as you might do spinach today. The stalks were not just boiled and just sort of snacked on. It was considered to be quite a delicacy if you could dip it into fish oil and then chew on it. I'll pass on trying that one, right? The seeds were often saved, and not just for wild celery, but for other plants as well. The seeds were something that would get you through the winter. It was like a grain or a seed that you could use for a variety of uses that was easy to save. And if you are a mobile population, carrying around packets of seeds is something to snack on that you can eat. That doesn't take a lot of weight, that you don't have this abundance of produce that you actually have to carry. Cattails are another one that you probably are familiar with. You probably have walked by a million times and you see them in edges of ditches and growing in swamps, but it was another very versatile food. Personally, if you're ever near a cattail in the spring when you have the green head, boil them up in some water and put some butter, salt and pepper, corn on the cob. Really good. Right. That's another treat that I still remember taking my children out, and the first time that we ever tried that, and they couldn't believe that they were actually eating cat's tails. But you have to do it when they're green, right? Right about now, another week or so, at least in the north. Here, you guys are probably past the season already. So cattails had a variety of uses as well. And tamarack is another thing that we should consider. Tamarack's not the only tree that was a food resource, but it was one of many. Tamaracks roots were eaten. They would peel them and they would add them to the cooking pot, as well as just chewing on it as well. The gum was scraped from tamarack trees and chewed as a sweet treat, similar to chewing gum as well. And the inner bark could be scraped off, and there was the substance in the inner bark was something that was eaten as well. By the mid-1940s, few, if any, Meshkigwik were still harvesting the parts of the tamarack tree that they had done historically for long periods before that. The 1670 arrival of the Hudson Bay Company inadvertently changes the Meshkigwik diet. That was not their intention, nor was probably even on their radar when they arrived on the shores of Hudson Bay. The newly arrived men brought a strong garden culture with them from England and Scotland, and the Hudson Bay Company itself expected that gardening was going to take place. They expected that their Hudson Bay gardens would be providing a large portion of the trading post food. The majority of the men were from Orkney, Scotland. They followed the directives of their English owners, and they planted the seeds that the English owners were sending each year on the supply ship. Each post had a large area dedicated to vegetable gardening, featuring a wide range of plant foods. And this is Severn Fort, as we call it Fort Severn, they called it Severn Fort at the time. And you'll see that about almost half, about two-thirds of the area is Area S, and Area S would have been their garden. So that's just one garden plot for one area. If you look at any of the original Severn Fort maps, you will see large portions that are dedicated to the garden itself. Most of the posts used Meshkigwik men as garden laborers, and they followed the British tradition of putting the men out to prepare the gardens for that planting and to get the garden started. This was the beginning of horticultural imperialism in Rupert's Land, right? Horticultural imperialism is this idea that it's the colonizer gardens that are changing the landscape and the culture of the people that are already living there. The Hudson Bay Company introduced new ideas about plant foods, how to acquire them, how to manage them, and how to eat them. And evidence of this change is visible with the entrance of European garden words into the Meshkigwik language. In 1732, James Isham, a Hudson Bay Company employee, made his list of English and Indian words, and several of them reflect the garden and the garden vegetables, and we can see several on there, as well as the word muskishi, which is Meshkigwik for plant foods, not necessarily translated literally as plant foods, but they just called that in any type of reference to those plant items that were eaten as food. By the early 1800s, First Nations gardens are being mentioned in the Hudson Bay Company journals. And by the mid-1800s, not only does the Hudson Bay Company expect Meshkigwik people to garden, the religious missions and the government agents are also expecting them to do so as part of the civilizing project, because as we all know, if you plant a garden, you're a civilized person and no longer a savage, right? At least according to the people of the day. They're not taking into consideration at all Meshkigwik culture, the roles of gender in food preparation, nor in the role that wild plant life played into the lives of Meshkigwik people. As the European-Canadian presence at the trading post increased and communities and First Nations reserves grew up around them, the availability of European-Canadian foodstuffs increased as well, and we start to see another transition occurring, and this is a shift from gardening to groceries as a food resource. The agrarian idea faded from the majority of Meshkigwik lifestyles, in part because the European-Canadian model of gardening did not fit Meshkigwik cultural patterns around the division of food and as well as food procurement. It also failed because the European-Canadian methods of eating these foods did not match Meshkigwik ways of cooking and eating, and this European-Canadian government dependency on groceries as part of a social support network further complicated understandings of food for First Nations people. The Hudson Bay Company began this chain of events that eventually compromised food security of Meshkigwik communities. First, they introduced the garden as a viable alternative to gathering plant foods. Second, they began the displacement of people from their natural environment, a once mobile lifestyle that followed the seasonal fluctuation of natural resources was replaced with one where people lived in a permanent location. Third, they supported the model of an idealistic, civilized European society that further perpetuated by the religious missions, by Canadian government, right? This idea of an Indian reservation where people lived in this model European lifestyle. The end result, of course, is a loss of Mushkegawik knowledge of traditional ways, especially the use of wild plants as a food resource. This occurred several generations ago because First Nations groups were no longer in touch with their heritage landscapes. The connections with the familiar plants and the familiar cycles of nature was actually broken. The replacement provided by the colonizers included gardening and later grocery shopping. Many Mushkegawik communities have paid for this shift in food security with compromised nutrition and health. And it's important for them and for us to relearn wild plant food knowledge, to create a sustainable system of food security that is diversified, that does provide sustenance to those people that need it. In 1670, the Hudson Bay Company began the shift in the Mushkegawik diet from gathered to gardened to groceries. And in 2013, we need to rediscover the lost heritage of Mushkegawik plant food history as a part of the solution of creating healthy communities. Thank you.